another name. He established an empire which extended from the Persian Gulf to the Mediterranean Sea, and even took in some of the larger islands in the Mediterranean Sea. Someday I'll tell you about Cain and his empire, but that's another story. Another bit of evidence is found in Genesis 11, verse 2, which tells us that after the flood, Noah's descendants journeyed from the east until they came to the land of Shinar. Therefore, they must have come from some place east of the Tigris in Euphrates valleys. And the only place where such a flood as the Bible describes could have occurred, eastward from the Tigris and Euphrates valleys, is this mountain basin in Sinkiang, which I have been talking about. Another bit of evidence is found in the high water mark found in many places along the mountains which rim this basin, showing that at one time this basin was a lake extending to this well-marked shoreline. The mountains which rim this valley were not fully covered, for many of them range from 16,000 to 25,000 feet in height, and one even rises more than 28,000 feet. But within the basin are several smaller mountains which could be fully covered by a flood held within the higher rim of the valley. In short, this basin, through which flows the Tarim River, and which is sometimes known as the Tarim Basin in southern Sinkiang, is identified as the site of Noah's flood. In your King James Version, Genesis 7, verses 11 and 12 read, "In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, the 17th day of the month, the same day were all the fountains of the great deep broken up, and the windows of heaven were opened. And the rain was upon the earth 40 days and 40 nights. More careful translation makes clear what really happened. In Moffat's Modern English Translation we read, "The fountains of the great abyss all burst, and the sluices of heaven were opened." In Smith and Goodspeed's American translation it says, "The fountains of the great abyss were all broken open, and the windows of the heavens were opened." That is, a great earthquake broke up the waterproof layer of rock over the immense water-filled abyss or cavern beneath this Tarim Basin, causing the floor of the valley to settle and allowed an enormous underground reservoir to overflow and to submerge the valley floor. The great earthquake in the Himalaya Mountains about 10 years ago produced similar effects in some places. Of course, the 40 days of torrential rains added to the flood. This filled the valley high enough to submerge the low mountains which were inside the valley. This is exactly as Genesis 7, verses 19 to 20 says. Don't be misled by the mistranslation, "All the high hills that were under the whole heaven were covered." The word mistranslated heaven is merely the Hebrew word shamah, meaning the sky. Since this Tarim Basin is somewhat more than 350 miles wide by more than 650 miles long, all the sky visible from anywhere near the center of this valley would cover only this valley, and therefore only those lower mountains which were within the valley itself. But what about Genesis 8, verse 4, reading, "And the ark rested in the seventh month, on the 17th day of the month, upon the mountains of Ararat"? Sometimes failure to translate can be just as misleading as outright mistranslation. Most people understand this to mean Mount Ararat in Armenia, some 1,600 miles west of the Tarim Basin. But this is not what the Bible says. First of all, note that it says mountains of Ararat, mountains being in the plural, while Mount Ararat in Armenia is only a single peak. But Mount Ararat in Armenia was known until comparatively recent times as Mount Massus, and nobody had ever heard of it being called Mount Ararat in Bible times. Furthermore, the Hebrew word Ararat means only the tops of the hills. Therefore, correctly translated, Genesis 8 verse 4 merely says that the ark came to rest upon the tops of the high hills, some of the lower mountains which were within the Tarim Valley. A recent newspaper report mentions an expedition equipped with the latest electronic equipment which is going to Mount Ararat in Armenia to find the ark, and which will melt the ice which covers the ark by coating it with black powdered carbon. But they won't find Noah's ark, for it is not there. Several expeditions have gone to this Mount Ararat to find the ark, and some of them got within sight of a mast on the side of a mountain, which from that particular point of view looked to be shaped somewhat like a ship. That point has been very carefully inspected from the air by airplanes flying over it very close, and it has proved to be nothing but a ledge of rock, which does give a silhouette shaped like a ship when seen from the right direction. I needn't mention the many places, such as the Grand Canyon and so forth, where similar ship rocks can be seen, and none of them are Noah's Ark. So when we carefully examine the whole affair and correct the mistranslations, we find there is no conflict between what the Bible really says and either science or history. In fact, there never is any such conflict. It is only the preachers who find themselves contradicted by either science or history. And that is only because they either won't take the trouble to find out what the Bible really says, or because they have made the mistranslation a supposedly sacred church doctrine, and now they are stuck with it. Don't let any church shake your faith in the Bible. The Bible is always right, even if the churches are often wrong. Let us remember another thing. The ancient Chinese historical record, the Shu King, records that during the reign of King Yao, at a time beginning about the date of Noah's flood, the Huang Ho carried excessive floods for three generations. Drainage out of the Tarim Basin to the eastward would have been carried off in the Huang Ho River and would account for this. Now we come to another false doctrine taught in many churches, that since nobody survived in all the earth except Noah and his family, everybody now living is a descendant of Noah and related by blood, no matter what race they belong to. But we have already seen that the flood did not cover the whole earth, but only one valley, about 350 by 650 miles in size. The Chinese history was not interrupted by it, although they do record purely local floods in the Huang Ho Valley, where the waters were draining off. We have seen that Egyptian history is not interrupted by the flood, so the continent of Africa was not touched by it, and the Negro race continued unaffected by it. It would be absurd to think that Noah and his wife, both of them being white, could have one white child, one Negro child, and one Chinese child. Remember that in Genesis 1, verses 11 to 25, when God created the world and its inhabitants and made the laws governing their reproduction, he did not make it absurd chaos with whales giving birth to cattle and fish hatching out of birds' eggs. His law, repeated several times for emphasis, is always that each creature must bring forth strictly after his own kind. The churches which teach this false doctrine of everybody being descended from Noah never got it out of the Bible, that is, in any true translation of the Bible. As Moses wrote it in the Hebrew language under divine inspiration, the Bible correctly tells that Noah's descendants went out into a world already populated by people who had lived right through the time of the flood and were still going strong. Ferrer Fenton's modern English translation gives this correctly. In Genesis 10, verses 1 to 5, we read of the descendants of Noah's son Japheth, and it says, "From these they spread themselves over the sea coast of the countries of the nations, each with their own language amongst the Gentile tribes." Genesis 10, verse 20 tells of the descendants of Noah's son Ham. "These were the sons of Ham in their tribes and languages in the regions of the heathen." Genesis 10, verse 31 completes it. "These are the sons of Shem, by their tribes and by their languages, in their countries among the heathen." So never let anybody tell you that the Bible consists of the fables of a primitive people. It is perfectly consistent with all true science and all true history. It is the history of our race, the Anglo-Saxon, Scandinavian, and Teutonic white race. This is Bertrand L. Comperet. And I've got a few more things in my mind about which I'd like to speak with you. And the first of these is, the Bible is scientific. So often we hear someone make the foolish statement that modern science has disproved the Bible, or disproved some part of it. Nothing can be further from the truth. There is no conflict between a correct translation of the Bible and that which is true science. Remember that many theories have been put forth as science and have been believed by many people, only to be proven false by more careful study a few years later. I will admit that there's a great conflict between what many ministers preach and what we know to be true science. But there's an even greater conflict between what these preachers say and what is really in the Bible. The Bible has its own purpose, and it sticks to that purpose. It does not purport to be a manual of instructions for the use and repair of an IBM computer, nor a textbook from which to teach schoolboys their mathematics. Its purpose is so much greater than any of these that it has no time to waste on them. Aside from the various laws governing agriculture, diet, economics, and so forth, about which I will speak some other time, the Bible's principal purpose in going into scientific matters is to prove the divine inspiration of the book by stating scientific matters which were not known by the best scientists of the day in which it was written, and which therefore could not be a display of merely human wisdom and knowledge. Let's look at some examples of science in the Bible. We all know that even when Columbus made his voyage to the Western Hemisphere in the year 1492 A.D., it was not generally known that the Earth was round. He faced the threat of mutiny from his crew out of fear that he would sail too close to the edge of the flat Earth and the ship would be swept over the edge to fall down into no man knew what. In fact, all who believed that the Earth was round, and they were very few in number, were regarded as heretics. Today we know that the Earth is almost exactly spherical in shape, and when seen from any direction, its outline is a circle. But God declared that fact to the prophet Isaiah in the year 712 B.C. It is found in Isaiah 40, verses 21 and 22. Have ye not known? Have ye not heard? Has it not been told you from the beginning? Have ye not understood from the foundations of the earth? It is he that sits upon the circle of the earth. And a Catholic friend of mine recently called attention to the fact that in her Catholic Bible, it says, he sits upon the globe of the earth. Until the days of Galileo and Newton, when modern gravitational science was born, it was not known that the earth could float free in space. People saw that everything fell down until it came to rest upon the earth itself. And if you picked up a rock or a handful of soil and dropped that, that too would fall down. Obviously, therefore, the entire earth itself must have the same tendency to fall down unless it was resting upon something strong enough to support the earth. That's how their wisest men reasoned and believed. They couldn't agree as to what it was that supported the earth. The Hindus, who have always prided themselves on being such a wise and spiritual race, were firmly convinced that the earth rested upon the backs of four elephants, and the elephant stood upon the back of a giant turtle. Neither their spirituality nor their wisdom were great enough to discover what it was that supported the turtle. Even the highly cultured and intelligent Greeks believed that the earth rested upon the shoulders of the giant Atlas. And they likewise could not find out what it was that Atlas stood upon. But in the book of Job, chapter 26, verse 8, we are told that he hangs the earth upon nothing. That is, the earth being supported by nothing, floated free in space. When we consider that the Job of this book is very probably the Jobab, that is, Father Job, of Genesis 10, verse 29, which would put the date of this scientific truth that the earth floated free in space at least 2000 B.C., we may be certain that it was not the current knowledge of the wise man, but a revelation from God. And consider also the other remarkable statement in this same verse, Job 26, verse 8. He stretches out the north over the empty place. Only a very small fraction of the stars can be seen with the naked eye. Even the smaller telescopes reveal vast multitudes of stars which had never been seen by man before that time. The problem is not one of magnification, for smaller telescopes can be made to magnify as many times as the larger type. It is rather that a small telescope can't take in enough light to make use of high magnification. That is why the astronomers have been making larger and larger telescopes, instruments which will gather in so much light that we can see stars so far away that their light is too dim to be seen or photographed with any smaller telescope. Great telescopes have revealed multitudes of dim, far-distant stars in parts of the sky where the unaided eye finds only darkness. But even our most powerful and largest telescopes can find nothing, just a blank, completely empty place in the sky in one spot in the north. Since no such telescopes existed in ancient times, it was divine revelation which told that God had stretched the north over the empty place. Today, we all know that the Earth rotates on its axis, the North and South Pole being the ends of this axis. But this knowledge is recent. In 1543 A.D., the astronomer Copernicus disputed the common belief that the Earth was the stationary center of the universe, with the sun, stars, and planets revolving around the Earth. This view was condemned by the Catholic Church as heresy. When Galileo, by his own studies and experiments, reached the same conclusion, he was tried for his life before the Inquisition in Rome, and he only escaped death by making a public recantation of this view. Nevertheless, these men in the 1500s and 1600s A.D. laid the foundation for modern astronomy with the knowledge that the sun is the center of our solar system, that the Earth revolves around the sun, and the apparent rise of the sun and stars in the east and their setting in the west is really due to the rotation of the Earth on its axis. But God took notice of this fact in the book of Job about 2000 B.C. In Job 38, verses 12 to 14, he asked, "Hast thou commanded the morning since thy days, and caused the dayspring to know his place, that it might take hold of the ends of the earth? It turns itself as clay of a seal." In other words, have you held on to the ends of the earth's axis while it turned itself? This was over 3,500 years before science discovered the fact of the earth's rotation on its axis. For countless thousands of years, men have noted the contrast between the salt water of the ocean and the fresh water which falls as rain. But it took more knowledge than they had to realize that this salt water of the ocean was the source of the fresh rainwater. Men had watched clouds in the sky since men existed, but they knew little of the nature of clouds. The ancients believed that the thunder was the noise of clouds colliding in the sky, which shows that they didn't know that clouds were only water vapor. But again, in the book of Job, chapter 36, verses 27 and 28, we find scientific truth revealed. "For he makes small the drops of water. They pour down rain according to the vapor thereof, which the clouds do drop and distill upon man abundantly." Not a man then alive knew that rain was distilled water from the ocean, which had lost its salt by the process of distillation. But God revealed this in advance of science. More of this is revealed in the book of Ecclesiastes. This book is generally credited to Solomon, and if so, it was written about 977 B.C. In chapter 1, verses 6 and 7, it says, "The wind goes toward the south and turns about unto the north. It whirls about continually, and the wind returns again according to his circuits. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again." Today we know that this is true. We know that the winds do whirl about continually, rotating in huge circles in a clockwise direction in the southern hemisphere and counterclockwise in the northern hemisphere. But even as a theory, a mere conjecture, This idea is of recent origin, and proof of its accuracy is very modern. Yet 28 centuries ago, the Bible told us, first, that the winds rotate in great circles, and second, that the water of the rivers, although fresh water, actually originated in the salt water of the oceans. When these facts were announced by Galileo in the first half of the 1600s, they were not believed, and they were denounced as dangerous heresies. So if you've been under the impression that the Bible couldn't stand examination by science, or that God needed to take some science classes under some left-wing liberal professors in our modern universities, then go back and read the Bible again. You will find it very scientific. But let's look up some more of these scientific facts in the Bible. We may take notice that the fact that light moves is a relatively recent discovery. Its rate of speed was proved only within the time of men now living. But in Job 38, verse 19, God asks, "Where is the way where light dwells?" Note that, not the place, which would imply that light is stationary, but the way, the path of moving light. That the lightning, the thunderbolt, moves is no new idea, of course. But only within the last 30 years have we had such high-speed movie cameras that we could discover a new fact about lightning. That the bolt of lightning does not start out all by itself. Before the lightning bolt can strike, there is first a small pilot discharge, which seems to serve no purpose but to prepare the air for the real lightning bolt to follow by ionizing the air so it becomes the conductor of electricity. That is, there must first be something to prepare a way for the lightning, to open the path for it. This, remember, was only discovered within your own lifetime. In fact, since World War II. But in Job 38, verse 25, God asks, "Who has divided a way for the lightning of thunder?" Don't let anyone tell you that this book is only a collection of primitive superstitions. At first impression, nothing would seem sillier than the idea that the air has weight. Of course, everybody is supposed to know that fact today. But it was first discovered by Galileo in the year 1630 A.D. Yet in Job 28, verse 25, it speaks of the weight of the winds. A century ago, man discovered that electricity could be used to deliver messages at a distance, the telegraph. But God knew all about that ahead of time, for he asked Job in Job 38, verse 35, "Canst thou send lightnings, that they may go and say unto thee, Here we are?" The Hebrew language had no word for electricity except lightning, so that's what Job wrote down. But electricity and lightning are the same thing, the only difference being in the amount of power involved. But let's not just stay on Earth, nor even in the solar system. Let's examine our entire galaxy, the multitude of stars which form the Milky Way. There are at least 30 billion stars in this one galaxy, which is shaped like a biconvex lens. Our own sun is one of the minor stars in this system, and its position is about two-thirds of the way out toward one edge of the galaxy. We are some 30,000 light years away from the center of the galaxy. Since one light year is about 5,870,000,000,000 miles, our distance from the center of the galaxy, being 30,000 times this much, is far more than 1 sextillion miles. In numerals, it is 1761 followed by 15 zeros. The entire galaxy, this vast lens-shaped mass of stars, rotates around its collective center of gravity, the whole galaxy making one rotation in about 200 million years. The center of gravity of the galaxy is marked by the star Alcyone, which is the brightest star in the constellation Pleiades. Now, considering that this is nearly 2 sextillion miles away from us, it was not easy to get acquainted with it, and our knowledge on the subject came within the lifetime of men still alive. Yet in Job 38, verse 31, God asks Job, "Canst thou bind the sweet influence of Pleiades?" Yes, it is a sweet influence, for it keeps us in our course, instead of wandering aimlessly through space until we would collide with some other mighty solar system. It is also worth noting that the Hebrew word for Pleiades, Kimah, also means pivot or hinge. I guess we'll have to admit that God is pretty much up to date after all. But if anyone is thinking that this is old-fashioned science of nature itself and does not include man's latest inventions, such as the hydrogen bomb, let me tell you that God also knew about that. All scientists agree that all of the stars, including our sun, generate their heat by the same process used in the hydrogen bomb. That is, four atoms of hydrogen combine to form one atom of helium, releasing the surplus energy at the most fantastically high heat. The hydrogen bomb is therefore an artificial and miniature star, characterized above all else by its extreme heat. Do you think that this is modern science? Then listen to 2 Esdras 15, telling of our defense when we are attacked by the hordes of Asiatic Chinese and Russians. The great and mighty cloud shall be lifted up, full of wrath, and the star, that they may make all the earth afraid, and them that dwell therein. And they shall pour out over every great and eminent place a horrible star. And they shall break down the cities and walls, mountains and hills, trees of the wood and grass of the meadows, and their corn. They shall come to her and besiege her. The star and all wrath shall they pour out upon her. Then shall the dust and smoke go up unto heaven, and they that be about her shall bewail her. And thou, Asia, that art partaker of the hope of Babylon, and art the glory of her person, woe be unto thee, thou wretch, because thou hast made thyself like unto her. Thou hast followed her that is hated in all her works and inventions. Therefore, thus saith God, I will send plagues upon thee, widowhood, poverty, famine, sword, and pestilence, to waste thy houses with destruction and death, and the glory of thy power shall be dried up like a flower, when the heat shall arise that is sent over thee. Note that this says that someone is going to Asia and will pour out over every great and eminent place there a horrible star. Now, the only star that anybody can carry to Asia and pour out over her important places is the artificial miniature star of the hydrogen bomb. It further adds that the power of Asia shall be dried up by the heat that is sent over it. Again, a clear reference to the hydrogen bomb, for its heat is even more destructive than its blast effect. Again, it mentions that the clouds of dust as well as smoke shall go up into heaven. No bombs of ordinary explosives have ever produced an effect that could be thus described, even by the most poetic fancy. But you remember that a characteristic of even the atom bomb, and in far greater measure in the hydrogen bomb, is the fact that the awful updraft from the fireball sweeps up a huge cloud of radioactive dust from the ground, as well as smoke from the fire started by the bomb. And this mushroom cloud of both dust and smoke has been measured as rising more than 25 miles into the sky. We have another reference to this in Isaiah 25, verses 2 to 5, which promises that to us God will be a shadow from the heat when the blast of the terrible ones is as a storm against the wall. But this same passage says that to our enemies, God will bring down the noise of strangers as the heat in a dry place, the heat with the shadow of a cloud. The only kind of cloud shadow that could bring heat is the awful shadow of the mushroom cloud of an atom bomb or hydrogen bomb. Again, Mark 13, verse 25, and Luke 21, verse 26, hold another and a hidden key. They say that the powers that are in heaven shall be shaken. Now, the word translated heaven is the Greek word Uranos, from which we derive the word uranium, the explosive of the atom bomb. And the word translated shaken also means agitated or stirred up. So there is here a strong hint that the powers that are in uranium are to be agitated or stirred up. And this has occurred only in the last 19 years. As I said at the start, God didn't try to write a mechanic's handbook for the operation and repair of present-day machinery, nor even a school textbook for teaching science. He had in mind other purposes far too important to allow waste of time on minor matters. But he knew that men are skeptical, that they must be convinced. So he included in the Bible enough science to convince anyone who has intelligence and an open mind, especially because most of this science was not understood by any man until practically our own times, thousands of years after it was written in the Bible. Never let anyone tell you that the Bible is old-fashioned, out of date, a book of ignorant superstitions. If you will only study it carefully, you will see that it proves itself to be the inspired Word of God, true in every one of His statements. Today, my subject is The Laws of God Would Stop Crime. Today, I want to discuss some of God's criminal law in the Bible. Our criminal laws today are very imperfect. The penalty imposed usually seems to have little to do with the crime, and it often leaves the criminal with the impression that he is being persecuted rather than justly punished. Also, for the more serious crimes, the penalty is not decided until long after the criminal has been sent to prison. So again, all connection seems to be lost. God's laws are simple and direct, and nobody can mistake the reason for the penalty and the justice of it. First, let's consider God's laws concerning theft. Why do some people steal? Obviously, in order to make a profit, to gain by the theft. If the amount stolen is big enough, the thief may be willing to spend a few months or years in prison for it. But God's law takes the profit out of theft. The thief loses. He does not gain. Leviticus 6, verses 1 to 5 provides that one who wrongfully withholds from the owner property entrusted to him for safekeeping, or property which he has found, must not only restore the thing to the owner, but must also pay him one-fifth of the value of the thing. But a true thief, one who got the property wrongfully in the first place, really takes a loss. If the stolen thing is recovered intact in his hands, he must restore double the amount of his theft. That's provided in Exodus 22, verses 4 and 9. But if he has consumed the stolen thing, or sold, or otherwise disposed of it, he must restore from 4 to 5 times the amount he stole. That really takes all the fun out of it, doesn't it? But suppose the thief is defiant. Suppose he says, "Well, I can't pay it, so what are you going to do about it?" God's law can do something about it. The defiant thief is sold into slavery for enough to pay what he owes. Suppose he owes $100. He is auctioned off after this fashion. Who will bid $100 for 1 week of this man's labor? If the thief is repentant and really wants to make amends for the wrong he has done, he probably will be a good worker, and possibly someone will bid $100 for a week of his labor. But suppose he is still sullen and defiant. It'll take a lot more than 1 week to get $100 worth of work out of him. There will be no bidders for 1 week, maybe none for a month's time, or even several months. The thief's own attitude can make it either easier or harder on himself, and the degree of punishment is exactly proportioned to what he needs. Also, the injured party receives some compensation for all his trouble and for the time he lost the use of his property. Again, consider the crimes of assault and battery and mayhem, inflicting bodily injury on another. Today, the law shows no connection between the crime and the punishment. Courts get in the habit of using the same routine penalty for all crimes, even though there is a great difference between the injury inflicted in the different cases. But God's law exactly proportions the punishment to the wrongful offense. The wrongdoer receives the same injury he inflicted on his victim. If he knocked out a tooth, he loses his own. If he broke an arm, his own is broken, and so on. The moral is clear. If you value your own hide, leave your neighbor's alone. If you don't want your own arm broken, don't wrongfully attack someone and break his arm. Even the dullest criminal can understand this. People of very philosophical mind, able to understand the connection between a violation of Section 240 of the California Penal Code and a fine of $25 imposed by the court some weeks later, these usually are not the ones who do violate it. The ones who do are those who are dull of wit but sharp of temper and who need some restraint. They can get the point of God's law much better. That is why God's law provided the same injury as the penalty in Exodus 21, verses 22 to 25, and Leviticus 24, verses 19 and 20. Once in a while, there is a case of a man who seeks to injure his enemy by making a false accusation against him, trying to get the law to punish his enemy for something which he never did. Again, God's law provides the right answer in Deuteronomy 19, verses 16 to 20. The false accuser receives the same punishment he tried to have wrongfully inflicted on his enemy, whatever that punishment might be. If he falsely accused his enemy of a crime punishable by a flogging, he himself was flogged, and so forth. Our own California Penal Code, Section 128, adopts a part of this rule. It provides that anyone who, by perjury, causes the execution of an innocent person is punishable by death. There are many other crimes, very serious crimes, which are very frequently committed under our modern law and which are becoming more common every year. I will not bore you with the statistics on how many murders, rapes, and robberies are committed every hour of every day in this country. Besides, they would be last year's statistics and not nearly as bad as this year's record. But these vast numbers of crimes are not committed by a large number of people. On the contrary, a comparatively few people, nearly all of them habitual criminals, commit this great number of crimes. Our modern law has become so distorted that its purpose no longer seems to be to protect society against the criminal, but just to furnish highly paid jobs for a lot of fuzzy-minded do-gooder social workers to coddle the professional criminal. God's law does not make this mistake. Its purpose is to protect the innocent from the wrongdoer. For willful murder, the penalty is death. See Leviticus 24, verse 17, Numbers 35, verses 16 to 21, and Deuteronomy 19, verses 11 to 13. One who killed by accident, however, without any wrongful intent, was not punished, and he was protected from any revenge on the part of the dead person's relatives. See Numbers 35, verses 10 to 15, and 22 to 25, and Deuteronomy 19, verses 4 to 6. For kidnapping, and also for rape, the punishment was death. See Deuteronomy 22, verses 25 to 27, and Deuteronomy 24, verse 7. It was intended that these vicious and loathsome crimes should be stamped out. Under God's law, we could not have seen the spectacle of a man guilty of these crimes delaying his punishment for many years until he exhausted the long-suffering patience of the courts. The penalty is to be death, swift and certain. The Bible says, "So shalt thou put the evil away from among you, and those which remain shall hear and fear, and shall henceforth commit no more any such evil among you." Adultery also was punishable with death. How that would depopulate Hollywood. Various minor crimes could be punished by flogging, but not more than 40 lashes. The state of Delaware had a statute authorizing flogging of robbers and burglars, but it had not been used for a long time. So in the year 1922, the situation became so bad that the insurance companies writing robbery and burglary insurance all agreed not to issue any more such insurance in the state of Delaware. This suddenly awoke the conscience of the Delaware courts to have the robbers and burglars flogged, and in 1 year these crimes were reduced to less than one-third of their former rate. Under God's law, habitual criminals who could not be reformed by such penalties were not allowed to continue to harm the innocent, nor were they supported at public expense for life. Death was the penalty for habitual crime. This alone would take care of almost our entire crime problem today, for most of our serious crimes are the work of habitual criminals. We still see large gangs of criminals running free in every large city, while our law must wait until after they have committed the robberies and murders they are planning. We must always sacrifice innocent victims on the altar of crime. God's law would not do that. These criminal gangs would all be destroyed because they are habitual criminals, and the honest people of the community would then have peace and safety. The Bible records that when our ancestors enforced and obeyed God's laws, they had peace and prosperity, and they were respected by the other nations. But Israel was condemned to captivity and exile because they abandoned the laws of God and followed the statutes of Omri, as the 6th chapter of Micah records. Today, we too are keeping the statutes of Omri, and we suffer the penalty in a frightful rate of crime, which is steadily getting worse. We have the record of 3,000 years of experience. Man's laws always fail, but God's laws alone will bring peace, prosperity, and safety. When will we learn to make God's laws the law of this land and thereby reap the benefits thereof?